Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we explore the pros and cons of building a nuclear power plant in southeastern Utah near the town of Green River. Reed Cyril, Senior Vice President for Business Development at Blue Castle Holdings, a Utah company seeking permits to build that plant, argues that nuclear power is a clean energy source that needs to be part of our energy portfolio. And he's my guest in the first half of the program. In the second half, we'll talk with Matt Pacenza, Policy Director for Healthy Environment Alliance of Utah, a group which opposes nuclear power in Utah. You're welcome to join this conversation, and the first half is a recorded conversation due to scheduling conflicts. Second half will be live with Matt Pacenza, but you can email us throughout the program, and we'll get those emails on the air under programs on our website, upr.org. You can click on Access Utah, and from the front Access Utah page, there's an email link, or you can call us at 1-800-826-1495. Matt Pacenza opposing the power plant in the second half, and now my conversation from a couple of days ago with Reed Cyril, who is with the company proposing the plant. You no doubt have heard about a nuclear power plant proposed for an area of Utah near the Green River, 3,000 megawatts. And, of course, it's been much in the news. We want to get the perspective of the company, which is proposing to build this plant, Blue Castle Holdings. And we are joined by Reed Cyril, Senior Vice President for Business Development. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let me give you a chance to give us some of the particulars of the project. What exactly are you proposing? Where is it? And how much power would it provide?
Well, after the three coal-fired generating stations that were under planning in the state of Utah were all stopped, several utility people in Utah and in some of our neighboring states in the country decided that the coal-fired generation was not going to be expanded in the state of Utah, and that along with expanding renewables, we needed to have some expansion of what we call baseload electricity. And there were just two options for that. One was natural gas, one was nuclear. In recent Public Service Commission hearings, the Public Service Commission had indicated that they were being uncomfortable with continuing to build more and more natural gas. So we began to investigate the possibility of pursuing nuclear energy in the state of Utah. And after looking very carefully at the laws in the state, we determined this was something that utilities could not initiate on their own just simply because of their regulatory scheme. Back east, the regulatory scheme is different. And that's why some of the states in the east have pursued nuclear energy. In Utah and the Rocky Mountain states, the regulatory scheme is basically all the same. And so basically we scoured the state of Utah and some areas in neighboring states, but primarily the state of Utah, to begin to identify the best areas in the state that meet the geophysical and other characteristics of a good nuclear power plant site, and found an excellent site down in the Colorado Plateau, began to look in that area, and selected a site approximately 4 miles northwest of the city of Green River. At that point in time, we began to investigate whether there would be water available. We did find some substantial amount of water rights that had been approved for power generation at coal-fired power plants that were never built. And that water has, ever since it was appropriated for those uses, have gone unused, continuing to remain in the river, ostensibly flowing down the river, being used by somebody other than the state of Utah. So we worked to acquire those water rights recently. That was approved by the state engineer. So what we are doing is just simply trying to provide an option. If the economics and the conditions become such that Utah needs more electricity, a base load resource that we have done the planning, the site work, it's necessary to deploy nuclear generation. That's what we're doing, and we believe the state of Utah is heading in that direction, and within 7 or 8 or 9 years, we will be needing to have more baseload generation and having the long, long process that it takes to deploy nuclear energy, 10 to 14 years, to have a number of those years under our belt will provide the state of Utah the ability to move forward rapidly with nuclear energy rather than having to wait 10 or 12 years to get that power and potentially suffer blackouts or maybe even brownouts in the meantime.
Oh, I was going to ask you how long the permitting process takes. 10 to 14 years, where are you in the process?
The permitting process itself is probably about an 8-year process. The once you have everything in place and begin on the actual application, it's a 4 to 5 year process. It took us about 3 years of preparation before we could commence the licensing process. We are about 3.5 years into that 8 to 10 year process.
Well, under an optimistic scenario, when could this plant be up and running?
The license itself could be available perhaps in 2016 or 2017 with about a 3.5 year construction period. So the absolutely earliest date that this electricity could be available for the state of Utah is 2021 or 2022. And that's not going to happen either. I mean, you're always, that's the best possible under the regulatory and legal scheme. You can never meet that schedule.
And as you say, you're trying to get ahead of the curve. You're and proponents of the plan are saying that by that those dates we'll have much greater energy needs and may not be able to be provided by other sources.
That's correct. And what's ideal about nuclear is that the laws in the country treat nuclear different than anything else. If you get a license, for example, for a coal plant or for a gas plant, construction must begin within 18 months after receiving the license. A license for a nuclear plant is actually good for 20 years. So if a license is obtained, then it's kind of like an option. You're ready then to make a decision when the economics are right, when the power load's right, anywhere within 20 years, anytime after 20 years of obtaining the license. So it's it really provides some tremendous flexibility for all of the utilities, be they municipal utilities, rural electric cooperatives, or investor-owned utilities like Rocky Mountain Power.
And is this accurate reporting? 3,000 megawatts is what the size that you'd be proposing?
Well, it depends upon the nuclear technology, but somewhere between about 2,100 megawatts and 3,000 megawatts. We have enough land and enough water. It really just depends upon which particular reactor is eventually chosen to deploy.
And what does that translate into in terms of numbers of houses that could serve, for example?
Well, the peak load for the state of Utah is somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 megawatts, so it's almost a doubling of energy that could be produced. One thing a nuclear plant does is that a nuclear power plant operates at very, very high capacity factors. A wind plant typically operates about 18 to 30% of the time. A coal plant, maybe 60 to 70% of the time. A nuclear plant, in excess of 90% of the time. So when you build capacity, you get a lot more out of that capacity from a nuclear plant than you do any other electric generating resource.
If you just joined us in this part of Access Utah, we're talking with Reed Searle, Senior Vice President for Business Development for Blue Castle Holdings. They're proposing a nuclear power plant near the town of Green River. In southeastern Utah, would provide up to 3,000 megawatts It's about half, we're hearing from Mr. Searle, of peak usage in Utah. And the concern of the company and other proponents of this is that by the time we get through the permitting and construction, Utah will need this energy. And so let's start now. Coming up, of course, we'll be talking to some opponents of the plant. I want to, and as you well know, Mr. Searle, many groups are opposed to this. What's your best case for why we should move forward with this plant?
Well, our best case is that primarily because of global warming concerns, coal-fired and air quality in general, and visibility issues in our beautiful state, coal-fired generation cannot be expanded in the state of Utah. And, in fact, because of some of the new air quality regulations, coal-fired power plants have begun to be shut down in the West, and more could be shut down. While we need all the resources we can for electric generation, wind and solar is important. It is expanding, but can only provide so much. And when the sun is shining and the wind's blowing, you need backup power, other power resources. There's only two available, gas and nuclear. We believe that the state of Utah should be diversified and have both of those. We're willing to put our money to do that. It is gas is still a highly air-emitting electric generating resource. Nuclear and wind and solar are the only non-emitting resources. It is expensive to build nuclear, but because it has such a low fuel cost and lasts for such a long period of time, the generating costs of nuclear are very competitive with other resources. So the state of Utah would gain by having another option for competitive power generation that is clean, and otherwise we're going to be perhaps importing power from other states and being subject to the availability of power from those states or from the ability to build transmission from those states into Utah. We need energy. We're going to be replacing retiring coal plants. The state of Utah and all other states find that these facilities take so long to build, they just have to be planned far in advance and have the options to get our electricity from a variety of sources. That's what this provides, one more excellent option.
In a post-Fukushima world, are you not heading into a headwind here, at least in public opinion, and legitimate concerns about safety? What if you'd address that?
The Fukushima incident was a very important incident for us to take a look at, and the United States has paid a lot of attention to there and has taken steps to even increase the safety of nuclear plants. For example, the plants that are the technology that's been approved now by the federal government does not need either electricity to provide the safety. It does not need operating pumps and electricity. It's all built in using gravity and using physics to provide all of the safety systems. It's extremely unlikely, of course, that such an event as happened in Japan could happen in the U.S. for multiple reasons. Obviously, the earthquake and tsunami combination stand as unique, and the loss of infrastructure of Japan's island nation was a major contributing factor in that disaster. Plants in the United States are subjected to a very intrusive regulatory system that requires that safety be established and systematically proved for every external possible hazard, including earthquakes, tsunamis, hurricanes, tornadoes, fires, floods, and etc. And furthermore, after 9/11, a very extensive series of measures were put into place at the cost of billions and billions of dollars at all nuclear plants in the United States, providing both on-site and off-site capabilities to deal with the consequences of any kind of external event or internal event, including fires, explosions, natural conditions such as earthquakes, hurricanes. So the United States has hardened its nuclear fleet dramatically and enhanced the engineering requirements of these plants dramatically to assure that we don't experience what happened in Fukushima. So that has been a wonderful learning experience, but it's been a tremendous learning experience for the United States, and the industry has been dramatically improved as a result of that experience. We've learned tremendous lessons, and these are all being incorporated into the nuclear generation industry. In the U.S., we currently have 104 operating nuclear plants and have never had any kind of an incident that not one human life has been lost, even at the one nuclear disaster that we did have in the United States at Three Mile Island. There was not a human injured by radioactive exposure at that incident either. So the U.S. is doing a pretty good job. We have a marvelous safety experience, and we have improved conditions here in the nuclear industry dramatically since 9/11, and even more importantly, since what happened in Fukushima.
If you just joined us, we're obviously talking about nuclear power. There is a plant proposed for Utah, and it has one water permitting. I believe that's the only permit needed from Utah. The rest is with the Nuclear Energy Regulatory Commission. Is that the case, Mr. Cira?
It is not necessarily the case. The governor of the state of Utah personally must give several approvals. For example, must be an exhaustive emergency response plan put into place, and the governor and the state of Utah have to approve that even before it's submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. But in terms of the licensing, it is, in fact, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that has to do all of the environmental studies, all of the safety studies, all of the technology and siting studies, and they issue all the permits and licenses that are necessary other than the one that the state engineer issued.
We are talking.
The governor does have to grant several approvals before we can move along to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
If you just joined us, we are talking with Reed Cyril, Senior Vice President for Business Development for Blue Castle Holdings. That's the company proposing this up to 3,000 megawatt nuclear power plant near Green River in southeastern Utah. I wanted to just follow up with the safety issues, and those safety controls and safeguards are very impressive. You state that the 104 power plants, nuclear power plants in the U.S., and operating safely. But I'm guessing you can understand people's concerns, especially when an incident like Fukushima happens. There have been others, Chernobyl and others. And some people will say, even with impressive safety standards and safety records in place, that if something goes wrong, perfect storm happens, the stakes are just too high. I wonder how you respond to that.
Well, I do sympathize with that attitude, and know that that can happen. There are just simply risks all over. The biggest risk that we experience in the United States with human health and safety is getting in an automobile. We don't close down our freeways because that poses a risk. This one of the larger risks by folks in Salt Lake County, and we're just so used to it, we don't quite understand it, is all of the gas refineries that we have in North Salt Lake. I just won't go through the potential risks that pose. Fortunately, we've never had a real serious experience, and so we've all become used to it, and we don't pay attention to that kind of a risk. To generate energy, we do in fact expose human beings to serious risks. Coal-fired power plants provide serious risks. They emit things into the air. I was in the coal-fired power generation business for 20 years. I understand those risks very well. They were not just risks. In fact, they're real. They do emit. In fact, the coal that we burn is radioactive. A coal-fired generation emits more radioactivity into the atmosphere than any nuclear plant has ever done. That's a potential risk that we just don't understand. So I agree there clearly are risks. They're significant. The world generates probably about 20% of all of its electricity through nuclear, and we've just deemed that with that tremendous benefit to humankind, that the risks that they propose, that they provide to us, are still acceptable to the majority of Americans. There's still a lot of polling going on in the country about what Americans feel about nuclear energy. Overall, the people in the United States still support nuclear energy, primarily in those areas that have nuclear generation going on now, because they understand it, they've lived by it, they're not overly threatened by it. Nevertheless, the Homer Simpsons, the China Syndrome movies, and Fukushima do cause people to have serious fears that are well justified. And we have to deal with those every day in just about every facet of life.
By the way, on that subject, have you gauged reaction or attitudes to this proposed plant from the people in that area, from the residents of Green River and surrounding areas?
We have. We have conducted two different public hearings in Green River, two in the city of Price, one in Moab. The citizens in Moab, who are there primarily for the beauty of that area, are, I'd say, rather overwhelmingly opposed to a nuclear plant in that area. As opposed to that, the citizens in Carbon County and in Emory County are about 95% in favor of this project.
Let me just quickly have you respond to a couple of objections to any nuclear power plant. I'm sure you've heard these. One is the waste, which is radioactive for hundreds of thousands of years, and we still in this country haven't come up with a plan to have a repository or to know what to do with that waste.
We have not come up with a plan long term. We have come up with a plan on what to do with it for the first 100 years of the waste life. Every power plant, nuclear power plant in the country now has the capacity to store its waste for 100 years on site. That is, in fact, one of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission requirements of us. If we were to operate for, say, 60 years and produce 3,000 megawatts of energy, 92% of every hour of every day, it would produce about 3 cubic yards of waste a year, 3 cubic yards, and that could be stored on 1.25 acre of land and on the plant site for 60 years. That's what it would generate. All of the waste that's been generated in the United States since nuclear generation began 50 years ago today can be stored on a site equal to 1 football field 10 yards high. The problem with this material is it is highly toxic and it has to be protected. The way it's done now is what we call dry casks. These are casks that you can put the nuclear waste in and then walk up to. You can handle them by hand. They can be dropped off of 10-story buildings and not crack. they're extremely secure and safe. Nevertheless, the material has to remain in those casks for 500 years before it returns back to the level of radiation that the ore had in it from which the uranium was derived. So for 500 years, you have to be able to do that. And one of the problems that the United States has is that it wants to dispose of material and yet be able to retrieve it for recycling, because the energy that's taken out by a nuclear plant is only 5% of the energy that's contained in uranium. And so we take the uranium and recycle it out of a nuclear power plant after it's lost 5% of its energy. 95% of its energy is still there. So the federal government, and it only makes sense that we don't dispose of that permanently, that when it becomes economically, we can recycle that and get the other 95% of the energy out of that uranium.
One of the other objections I've heard that nuclear power is water intensive. I don't know if that's true. You can address that. And will you have sufficient water from the river there?
Yes. A nuclear power plant uses slightly more water for cooling than does a coal-fired power plant. And that's just a matter of thermodynamics. A coal-fired power plant is a little bit more efficient with water, slightly more efficient, because it uses higher water temperatures than does a nuclear power plant. And that's the only difference. So if we have lots of coal-fired power plants in the state of Utah, each of those on a per kilowatt hour of electricity generated uses almost identically the same amount of water, slightly less than does nuclear energy, but it's the same stuff. It's the same thing. All you're doing is cooling steam to turn it back into water. That's the process. It doesn't matter if you're heating it with uranium or whether you're heating it with coal. The process of water use is essentially the same.
I'd like to have you address, or come down to the end of conversation here. People will have seen reports about your financial backing, and some are saying that a proposed $30 million infusion from Lead Dog Hedge Fund was significant in the decision by the state engineer to grant water permitting. I've seen your CEO rebut that, and the engineer himself is saying that he doesn't know which way, you know, that it may not have been significant. But will you have sufficient financial backing for this? It's fairly expensive, isn't it? I've read reports, $100 million for permitting, $18 billion to construct.
Our company's in business basically to obtain the license, and that's $100 million. In order to obtain the license, you do have to have secured the water and a site. And we do have access to the $100 million. It's primarily being internally generated by a subsidiary that we own called Willow Creek. At the time of the application, you submit your financials at the time of the application. At that time, we were negotiating with this company called Blue Dog for financing. We were negotiating with others as well, but that was the one that we were furthest along. That's what we reported to the state engineer. We eventually became uncomfortable with them and did not consummate any financial arrangement with them. That was terminated probably 6 or 8 months after our application. We thought that the decision would be made within 3 or 4 months. It took the state engineer 2 years. You don't go back and update your application every 3 or 4 months. So no additional information with regard to the our financial changes were submitted to the state engineer. But we never did any business with this organization. We had a contract where they had agreed to provide the funding. We never executed that contract in its final form, did not do business with them. Fortunately, we made that decision. They just didn't smell right to us, so we dealt with other entities and had no further relationships with them at all. So, yeah, we I'm not sure there's a financial entity on Wall Street that raises funds that we haven't dealt with and talked to and worked with.
And for people who didn't see the report, this hedge fund lead dog has now been accused by the SEC of questionable practices. So you were never in business with them. This was just a potential.
It was a potential, and it was at the time of the application, we thought it was our best potential, and we stopped dealing with them before we ever executed any contracts. So they just didn't meet a good smell test for us, and it sounded like there was reasons for that.
Do you think there will be a challenge to the state engineer's decision?
Oh, certainly.
You're expecting that to happen.
As to the state engineer, that's basically tells us that's why it took 2 years, is that he vetted everything so thoroughly. There were hundreds of letters or comments, and he went through every single comment and dealt with them extensively in writing. And so that's why it took so long. We believe that there definitely will be challenges, but believe that the state engineer did an excellent job and that his decision will hold up.
Finally, what's next? The next process and permitting is with the Nuclear Energy Regulatory Commission?
That's correct. We are will be submitting our application for the early site permit, and that's the environmental portion of the permit. There's another permit that still has to be applied for, and that's called a combined operating construction license. But for now, our application is what's called the early site permit. It's all the environmental work, site work, and that will be submitted. Our application will be ready for submittal of the first quarter of 2013.
Very good. We appreciate you coming on to talk about this. Reed Searle is Senior Vice President for Business Development with Blue Castle Holdings. They're proposing a 3,000-megawatt nuclear power plant near Green River. We'll hear, of course, much more about this, including later in this hour. Thanks, Mr. Searle, so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah. That's my recorded conversation from last week with Reed Searle from Blue Castle Holdings. That's the company put together to seek permits to build a nuclear power plant in southeastern Utah. We're on live now and will be so in just a couple of minutes following our Thad Box commentary with Matt Pacenza, Policy Director for Healthy Environment Alliance of Utah. That's a group which opposes nuclear power in Utah. We'll get the opposing point of view, and we can take your comments via email or telephone. For the rest of this half hour, the number to call is 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or you can get an email through to us from the Access Utah page on our website, upr.org, upr.org. Much more coming up following the commentary.
Commentator Thad Box.
Scientists tell us that the climate is changing and that those changes are due to human actions. This relates directly to our ethical relationship to each other and to the land itself. 72 years ago, a forester named Aldo Leopold presented a paper that redefined our roles as citizens. Widely published, his ideas became the basis for our current understanding of land. Leopold's concept was based on a land ethic. He said a land ethic changes the role of Homo sapiens from conqueror of the land community to a plain member and citizen of it. He further said that an ecological interpretation of history shows that man is only a member of a biotic team. In other words, we are dependent on the land. Our very survival depends on keeping it healthy. The trouble is, most human beings of this biotic team today have little contact with the land. They buy its bounty in big box stores and watch its processes on electronic screens. Many consider it just a place to build a house. Others see it as part of an economic system, such as land, labor, and capital. It is all of those things, but it's more. It's a functioning system of which we all are a part. Our job as citizens of the 21st century is to help others understand that land is not there to serve us, but we're here to be part of the land. We must guide 7 billion people and a global economy to see themselves as part of a large interrelated community. Technology changes relationships between us within that community, But every one of us is part of that land. Sustainability of our species depends on cooperation. After all, we are part of this land. This is Thad Box.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. In the first half of the program, we heard a proponent of nuclear power in Utah, and a specific project has been proposed. It's a nuclear power plant that would be built in southeastern Utah, about 4 miles outside of the town of Green River. And we heard many of the reasons from Reed Cyril from Blue Castle Holdings why he thinks and other proponents think that we do need nuclear power, including the increased energy needs that Utah and the rest of the United States will have, the fact that nuclear power is non-emitting, and if you compare it to other clean sources, it's the only viable one in their view. To be in the same category, they view it as wind and solar, and other sources of energy have problems. Natural gas and coal are emitters, and where do we go for our energy? The earliest that this plant could go online would be 2021. Mr. Cyril says that that's not realistic, but given the increase in energy needs that we'll see in the future, we need to start now. We'll have an opposing point of view in this half of the program, and we are pleased to welcome in Matt Pacenza, Policy Director for HEAL Utah, Healthy Environment Alliance of Utah, a group which opposes nuclear power in Utah. Matt Pacenza, thanks, and welcome to Access Utah.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. So I know that you and your group oppose this. I wonder if we could frame this to begin with how realistic do you think this will be? How do you think this is a distinct possibility? And I'm basing this off of your website, where you kind of give a history here, that when then-Representative Aaron Tilton proposed this, it just seemed like tilting at windmills, but now they've got capital. They say sufficient capital to go forward with the permitting process. They've got at least a couple of the permits that they need. It's a long road of permitting even to get to construction. How realistic do you think this project is in terms of its actually being built?
Well, I think it's a difficult question to answer. I think ultimately their biggest obstacle is actually not permits. The federal agency that handles this, the NRC, is frankly just notoriously cozy with the nuclear power industry, and they don't tend to say no. They're in the business of making nuclear power happen. So we assume they would say yes if we do move that far forward. But their critical obstacle is not those permits, but is in fact simply money. And Mr. Searle is a good spokesperson and obviously a very intelligent man, but he did manage to sidestep in that half hour any question about the economics of nuclear power. And the bottom line is we really haven't built nuclear power in the United States in the last 25 to 30 years. And the reason overwhelmingly is simply because it's too expensive and it does not compete with other alternatives. And right now those leading alternatives are natural gas and wind, which are simply cheaper and they're much quicker to build. They're much quicker to come online. And they provide good power, and that's why utilities across the country have turned their back on nuclear power.
I want to talk about those alternatives, and Mr. Cyril, other proponents do put this up as an us versus them, that, you know, nuclear versus coal. Coal is dirty. Natural gas also emits. And they bring up the objection that wind and solar are great. Geothermal you could throw in there as well, but will they ever be ramped up to the point where they can satisfy our energy needs?
You know, we do think so. And HEAL Utah actually commissioned a technical study, which we call eUtah. You can search that on the web and read all about it. But basically, we sketched out a study showing that a slow and steady transition to renewable energies, if we begin soon, is both feasible and affordable and reliable and can, in fact, power all of our energy needs. We're seeing in the marketplace right now that wind in particular is just growing by leaps and bounds. The prices are coming down, and all across the country, everywhere from Massachusetts to Iowa to Texas, we're seeing just sort of huge investments in wind and really rapid growth in that area. And solar is not quite there yet in terms of being, you know, dollar for cents competitive today. But prices are plummeting, and they've been going down an average of 7% a year for the last sort of half dozen years. And so it's really interesting to talk to folks who are choosing, for example, to put solar panels on the roofs of their homes. And you'll find that what they're paying is actually a lot cheaper than you probably think. Mm. And it's paying back much quicker than you might think. And we just think, you know, day by day, month by month, year by year, more and more people are going to make those choices. And we really wish that Utah, which unfortunately ranks virtually dead last in the country in the proportion of our power that comes from renewables, could in fact sort of, you know, get on board our 21st century energy economy and look to the future and you know, stop being, you know, at the back of the pack rather than the front.
Utah is very heavily dependent on coal, is it not? And of course, that's a non-renewable energy source. It's dirty. But to reach critical mass, to make all of this viable, is it going to be the economic forces, or will government have to get involved?
Well, government is involved. You know, government has always been involved. Government has, over the years, subsidized every energy source, whether it be oil or coal or nuclear. Frankly, nuclear is probably the number one most heavily subsidized and remains so. One thing Mr. Searle chose not to tell us about is the only scenario where they could possibly put together the money to build a Green River reactors is by applying for federal loan guarantees, where taxpayers, me and you, will guarantee up to 80% of construction costs for this project. And if the project goes south, if they start to build it and they realize it doesn't make any sense, then you and I will pick up 80% of that tab. So subsidies have played a role in energy, you know, from day one, and they'll continue to do so. And they are playing a role in helping wind and solar reach the marketplace. But just as with a good example, a good analogy is hybrid cars, where for the first few years of hybrid cars, you would get this kind of big rebate. If you bought a hybrid car, you'd maybe get a check in the mail for $2,000-$3,000. Well, that's gone now. People are still buying hybrid cars because they make sense. And the same thing's going to be true of wind and solar. There's some bridge financing to help them enter the marketplace, and they're not going to need it soon. And they'll be able to charge forward and make up an important part of our energy mix.
If you just joined us, we are talking about a proposed nuclear power plant for southeastern Utah. In the first half of the program, we talked with Reed Searle, Senior Vice President for Business Development at Blue Castle Holdings. That's the Utah company seeking permits to build the plant. And now we're talking with Matt Pacenza with HEAL Utah, which opposes nuclear power in Utah. You're welcome to join this conversation if you would like at 800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. What about the argument that nuclear is non-emitting, therefore should be considered along with solar and the other alternative energy sources?
I think that, you know, while we certainly would, you know, agree with the characterization that, you know, nuclear power does not emit carbon into the air, it doesn't emit, you know, sulfur and various other kinds of pollutants, the problem with calling nuclear clean energy is it ignores the entire uranium fuel cycle. So one thing we know very well in Utah, and especially in southern Utah, is the process of mining uranium, of processing uranium, and of enriching uranium does in fact produce a lot of pollutants and a lot of toxins. And we have, you know, hundreds and thousands of Utahns over, you know, decades who have paid the price for that, literally with their lives and their bodies, and become sick and died because of, you know, being poisoned by the process of, you know, both getting uranium out of the ground and then enriching it and processing it. So it's important to factor that in before you rush to call nuclear power clean energy. But, you know, despite the fact that it may not put pollutants out, it certainly does produce another material, which is nuclear waste. And Mr. Searle spoke about high-level nuclear waste when he was giving those sort of fairly small quantities that the waste puts off. And I don't think he was technically wrong about his numbers, but he didn't happen to tell us about low-level waste. And low-level waste produces a much larger quantity, and it still is dangerous and hazardous. And guess what? It comes to Utah. We have the nation's, of course, largest low-level radioactive waste dump site, 80 miles west of Salt Lake City, which is run by Energy Solutions. And that's a big part of HEAL's work. We're a watchdog group that keeps an eye on them and is always fighting to keep them from bringing, you know, hotter and more dangerous material here. And that stuff's being produced at nuclear power plants all across the country, and most of it comes here to Utah, and it's hazardous. And we don't think personally that at least that is one of the reasons why we think that nuclear power is a poor choice for Utah, because then we're just sort of, you know, taking more and more of this stuff. So, you know, it's clean in quotes. There's certainly problems, though.
I'd like to tackle the problem of waste. There's some other things specifically dealing with a nuclear power plant and whether or not we should build one. But the waste, whether or not a nuclear power plant is built in southeastern Utah, we've still got waste. And the nation is struggling about what to do with that. We thought maybe Yucca Mountain, but that's gone off the boards. Now there's a new blue ribbon panel. What are we ever going to do about this with this waste?
Yeah, I mean, it's fair to say that we're, you know, about 50 years into the global nuclear power age across the globe, and there really isn't any country on Earth that's figured this out. There's a few Scandinavian countries that have gotten closer and are beginning to build these sort of extraordinary deep geological underground facilities to store this high-level waste, the really super dangerous stuff that'll remain hazardous for, you know, millennia, for hundreds of thousands of years. But in the United States, we've had a series of failed bids to find a location from that, including, of course, Yucca Mountain, which you just mentioned. We also, you know, locally had a proposal for, quote, interim storage, where they would have put it on the Goshute Reservation in Skull Valley, not all that far from Salt Lake City. And fortunately, that proposal was defeated thanks to the opposition of Utahns and our congressional delegation. So President Obama did appoint this high-level commission to come up with an answer, and they unfortunately have endorsed an interim storage model where basically what they would do is they would take their time and find that good long-term permanent deep underground solution. But in the interim, they like the idea of taking all this high-level waste from our 100-plus nuclear power plants across the country and shipping it somewhere where it might stay for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And we fear that Utah could be in the crosshairs of such a bid to provide for interim storage. So Heil's been involved in that process, and we've made our comments to the commission. And we hope that while we sort of applaud their focus on the long-term answer, we're deeply concerned about their sort of their other idea, which is to do this interim thing in the meantime.
We do have a caller. Let's go to Sarah in Moab. Sarah, I understand you have a couple of comments. So welcome to the program.
Yes. Yes, I'm with Uranium Watch in Utah. I had some comments on Mr. Searle's statements. He seemed to indicate that the only permits would be from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the governor's approval of emergency response planning, but there are a number of other permits. They would even need a conditional use permit from Emory County. Also, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission would be involved, and the State of Utah Public Service Commission, and other state regulatory agencies that deal with the generation of electricity. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service would be very much involved because of the impacts to endangered fish species by the withdrawal of water on the Green River. There would be the State Air Division of Air Quality would also be involved because of potential off-site non-radiological emissions. And when they talk about nuclear power, they say there are no emissions. But when you look at the whole nuclear fuel cycle, from uranium mining and milling to the processing creation of the fuel, there are a lot of CO2 emissions and radioactive emissions. The last thing with Mr. Searle's statement regarding that, the application, he said our application, Newcastle Holdings did not submit the application. In fact, they didn't. The applications were submitted by the Kane and San Juan County Water Conservancy Districts, which lease the water first to Transition Power Development and later to Newcastle Holdings. And those applications happened in 2009. It was not until 2010 that in October that Council for Blue Castle for the Conservancy District submitted just a press release from Blue Castle Holdings talking about the lead dog arrangements. And throughout 2011, a lot more testimony was submitted. Blue Castle Holdings could certainly have informed the state engineer and the Water Conservancy Districts that they did not have agreement with lead dog. That's my comment.
Oh, great, great. Just before we let you go, Sarah, and we'll have Matt Pacenza respond to some of the things you said there. Appreciate that perspective from Uranium Watch. Is it fair to say we're going on under the assumption from reports that we're hearing that Grand County is very much opposed to this, so the majority of people in Grand County?
Well, I don't know about the majority of people. There are quite a number of people who are opposed to this because of the impacts to the river, the impact to the recreation on the river and the whole area. And this is a very beautiful and unique area, and it does not behoove the state to place a nuclear reactor in this beautiful, unique environment.
Very good. Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate the call. And Sarah called 1-800-826-1495. You can as well. We're talking about a proposed nuclear power plant that, if built, would be 4 miles outside of Green River in southeastern Utah. 1-800-826-1495 is the number. We had a proponent of the plant on in the first half, and now we have Matt Pacenza with Heal Utah Group, which opposes that plant. Matt Pacenza, anything you'd like to add to what Sarah said?
Yeah, I think it's really great that Sarah brought back the lead dog point, and I want to just hop on that for a second. That Mr. Searle paints a picture of, well, we made an agreement, and then a few months later we found out they weren't so reputable, and we walked away. And Sarah, first of all, makes an excellent point, which is that there was then nearly 2 years that followed where Blue Castle had, literally unlimited opportunity to let the state engineer know that this $30 million investment no longer existed. They chose not to. And the state engineer, in his decision just a couple weeks ago now, cited that money as one of the reasons that he thought they had the financial ability to actually make this happen. So I don't know what you call that. It's some sort of dereliction of duty or being deliberately misleading or something. But I find it fairly astounding that Blue Castle chose not to let the state engineer know that this money didn't in fact exist. And the second thing to point out is that even when they made the announcement, which they made in 2010, that they had this $30 million from this New York City hedge fund. We now know that at that time, that hedge fund had no more than $3 or $4 million. And Blue Castle puts out a press release saying, we're going to get $30 million from them. And that basically leaves me with two questions, which is either A, did you not even look into this to find out that they were this tiny enterprise that didn't remotely have funds, or B, did you know full well, but you chose not to let anyone know that because you knew it would never actually happen, and all you wanted to do was to put out a press release to make it seem like you were attracting investment. And either way, I just think it's super troubling. And if we're interested in actually having nuclear power in Utah, and of course at Heal, we think that's a bad idea, but even if you are in favor of it, are these the kinds of folks that you want building it? Folks who are either don't even bother asking where their money comes from and whether it exists, or folks who deliberately mislead? And I find either alternative very troubling. And I think that everyone in the state, from the state engineer to the governor to all of us, should certainly realize that these do not seem like the kind of fellows we want to give the keys to a nuclear power plant to.
Is your group planning, or do you know of another group planning to challenge that ruling by the state engineer?
There will definitely be a challenge. It's a sort of an administrative appeal. It's called a request for reconsideration. I don't think anyone has formally announced that it'll happen, but those are due in about a week, and there will be challenges.
I'd like to get your opinion on the way this might move the mix of a total mix of energy and where nuclear fits in. There's some prominent environmentalists who said nuclear has a place. That was pre-Fukushima. In a post-Fukushima world, do you think that's going to move? targeting specifically the environmental movement?
Yeah, there are, you know, a few sort of high-profile folks who have come out and have said, you know, oh, maybe we need to consider this because of the carbon issue. And I can certainly understand that. I mean, climate change is a genuine concern, and carbon is something, you know, we should all focus on. But with that said, I think that what makes nuclear power a poor alternative are, first of all, as we've said several times, the economics. You know, you're talking about a power source that's going to cost you somewhere around 15 to 18 cents per kilowatt hour, and which requires fairly massive subsidies from the government. Wind, on the other hand, is down in the 9, 10, 11 cent range right now. And solar is right around where nuclear is, or maybe a touch more, but it's coming down. So we have limited subsidies. Why would we put that subsidies into something like nuclear, which has, you know, so many associated problems, instead of a genuinely clean energy source like wind or solar? And the second issue, I do think it's fair to talk about Fukushima. And Mr. Searle spoke about, you know, the incredibly unique circumstances there and how nothing could happen in the United States. But one thing we like to point out is that, you know, we've had somewhere along the line of 500 or 600 nuclear power plants on Earth. And we've had three of them, which have had catastrophic failures. And that's Chernobyl, and that's Three Mile Island, and that is, of course, Fukushima. So that's a ratio of somewhere along, you know, one out of every 150 or 200. That is not a number which is zero. That is a number which is higher than zero. And it is fair, I think, to recognize that while the risks of an accident at a Utah nuclear power plant are low, they're admittedly quite low, they do exist. And the problem is that the consequences of such an accident are so catastrophic. And just some real quick facts about Fukushima, you know, people like to say, oh, well, no one's died. First of all, that's incredibly premature. We won't know for decades what the impact is on cancer rates. But second of all, there's something along the lines of 80,000 people who have had to leave their homes, quite possibly permanently. They will be out of their homes for several decades. And there are something along the lines of 20,000 businesses, mostly farms and fisheries, which have had to close their doors, probably permanently. And those are extraordinary impacts, and I don't think we should downplay them. And I certainly think the people of Japan are taking a second look at nuclear power. The Germans are walking away from it. All kinds of plants across the world are being shuttered because people are worried. And we would like to see that same concern here in Utah. And we'd like to see folks realize that there are better alternatives. We don't need to, you know, put our resources into something that uses so much water, which is so expensive, which produces so much dangerous waste, and which finally is the idea of a company which is, you know, appeared to be comfortable making arrangements with effectively a criminal enterprise, a hedge fund in New York City. So there's just all kinds of reasons to walk away from this, and it's time. Now's the time. We've learned enough, and let's actually build a 21st century energy economy.
We'll leave it there, out of time. We're talking with Matt Pacenza, Policy Director for Healthy Environment Alliance of Utah, or HEAL Utah. And HEALUtah.org is the website. You can learn much more, not only about the Green River Reactor, but energy solutions and HEAL Utah's plans for the whole energy mix. Matt Pacenza, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll debate a proposal by Representative Ken Ivory. He is proposing legislation which would challenge the federal government's ownership of land in Utah. He would set a deadline for the feds to turn over the land. And if they didn't do it, then they would the state would step in with taxes and liens. I think perhaps what the representative would like is a court challenge which would perhaps change the balance of land ownership in the West. That's coming up. We'll have Ken Ivory in favor and Representative Joel Briscoe opposed. That's the first half of the program. And in the second half, we'll take a look at the Democratic Republic of Congo with the Deputy Minister for Communications of that country, John Paul Aloa. That's the program tomorrow. Hope you'll join us. Thanks for joining us today for Access Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.